This spring, Canada's Minister of Justice, Vic Taves, introduced two bills as part of the Tories' Tough on Crime agenda. One of the bills, Bill C-10, proposes to place mandatory minimum sentences on various gun crimes. The Tories had originally wanted to include drug crimes as part of this bill, but dropped that part of the bill as they figured it wouldn't pass in the Parliament if it was included. Now, the Tories have stated that they hope to introduce a separate bill introducing mandatory minimums for drug laws in the near future. Canada already has mandatory minimum sentences on almost 40 different crimes under the Criminal Code. Concerned advocates from across the country and from a wide range of groups have expressed grave concern about the increased use of mandatory minimums, and particularly mandatory minimums for drug laws. Here to talk to us more about mandatory minimums and drug laws is Joanne Chetta. She's the executive director of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. Thanks for joining us, Joanne.
Thank you, Emily, and thanks for highlighting the issues of prison justice.
Can you start by telling us more about mandatory minimums? What are they and how do they work?
Mandatory minimums are pretty much what they sound like. They take away discretion about sentencing from judges who, under Canadian law, have a lot of discretion for certain categories of crimes. And they pretty much lay out in the law that for certain crimes, there has to be a certain minimum amount of time served in prison. So they're really the antithesis of things like house arrest or, you know, electronic bracelet kinds of so-called conditional sentencing. And they take us way far away from any kind of effort to find alternatives to prison for those crimes that are affected by the law.
And what is the Tory government's claim with mandatory minimums? What do they claim they're going to achieve with this?
Well, in the analysis that is in the bill that was put forward by the Harper government, there is the suggestion that so-called conditional sentences or house arrest type penalties have been overused in Canada and have been overused especially for serious crime. But as you suggested, this is really the best example you could possibly think of a policy that's meant to help politicians look tough on crime, but really is not based on good rational evidence.
So that was my next question. Is there any evidence that mandatory minimums achieve their goals? And if not, why go down this road?
Yeah, especially for drug crimes. It's amazing that you don't often have a kind of a natural experiment having already played itself out so vividly as this one has in the United States, where there have been several periods in U.S. history where mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes, including relatively minor crimes, have been applied. And that's happening currently in the U.S., although some of the 50 states are trying to find more alternatives to prison. But basically, you have this experience in the United States that has shown that this policy has filled prisons across the country with people who have committed nonviolent drug-related crimes. It has set back rehabilitation, obviously, because rehabilitation in prisons in the U.S., as it would be here in Canada, is a very limited matter. And it has especially caught in its net smaller scale offenders. And why is that? Because the discretion on sentencing gets taken out of the hands of judges who are impartial, at least in theory, and it puts it into the hands of prosecutors who can then make deals based on information and other things that people can trade. And it's rare that the smaller scale offenders will have access to the kind of information that would allow them to trade for a better deal from the prosecutor. So the bigger guys get off. They always have ways to protect themselves, and the small scale dealers, the nonviolent, often first time offenders in the U.S., have swelled the ranks of people in prison, including, I should add, many, many, many women. There's been an 800% increase in the incarceration of women for drug crimes in the period of this last period of mandatory minimums for drug crimes in the U.S. And again, that's because women either don't want to trade against the man that they may be with, or they don't have the kind of information that would help them to get a good deal. So this policy has failed in every possible way. In the U.S., drugs are more plentiful than ever. We know that this has not made a dent in drug crimes, But it's made a lot of politicians look like they're tough on crime.
So you were mentioning a little bit there about how mandatory minimums magnify some systemic discrimination and systemic problems in the criminal justice system. Can you comment a little bit more on how you see that playing a role in the introduction of mandatory minimums?
Well, it's a little bit hard to say, but it's clear that if the whole system is driven by how many arrests can be made and how many people can be thrown behind bars, you have a real, you give law enforcement officials a real incentive to engage in all kinds of practices that they might not otherwise if the goal were rehabilitation or helping people to find access to the health services they need. So in the U.S., a lot of analysts would say that the mandatory minimums have really gone hand in hand with practices like racial profiling, because there is the sense that it may be easier to get a conviction on an African American or on a Hispanic American. In any case, the whole matter of women and their role in drug crimes, often an accessory role, nonetheless has landed them with long sentences in many cases. It's a system that has perverse results. It's based on no good evidence. And in fact, the Ministry of Justice in Canada studied the matter under the former government and did a really good analysis of what the U.S. experience has been and said that, at least for drug crimes, this just doesn't make sense.
So some people say that we need to target the dealers.
Sell a small amount of drugs just to be able to maintain their own addiction, and those people would be treated under these laws unless the law were very, very different from the U.S. law, which is hard to imagine, but these people would be treated pretty much the same as someone who's kind of a full-time, larger-scale trafficker. So, in fact, these laws also have the tendency to make that distinction between dealers and users a very fine line indeed.
And what about what's going on in terms of drugs and drug use behind bars now and sort of maybe foreseeing via looking at the states or into the future in Canada if mandatory minimums were introduced for drug laws? How would that affect the relationship between those on the inside using drugs and the availability of drugs? Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I think it's a frightening prospect, and this is a little bit why an organization like mine, which is focused on HIV/AIDS-related human rights and legal questions, has gotten into this discussion. You have denial right now in Canada that there are drugs in prison, and specifically that there is injection of drugs in prison, whereas we know that that happens, and we know that people are injecting with pretty much any sharp object they can find sometimes, and hepatitis C and HIV both are spreading in prison at a rate that's many times faster than that of people outside prison. Now, as long as you have that kind of denial informing the policy, that means that Canada, unlike a number of Western European countries, unlike a number of even former Soviet countries, unlike Iran, if you can believe it, will not even think about having programs in prison where sterile syringes are provided. This means that if you're going to be throwing drug users, and in many cases people who inject drugs, into prison at a high rate, you're just going to be feeding this horrible health crisis that's happening with bloodborne diseases behind bars, because there is no access to sterile syringes, which, you know, every excuse in the world has been found, but these programs have existed for years and years now in many countries. Needles have never been used as a weapon in countries like Switzerland, Spain, even Kyrgyzstan, even now, as I say, Iran. And actually, in places like Switzerland and Spain, where these programs have been around for a long time, the biggest advocates are the prison guards, the prison staff, because they know if they do a pat-down search, it's much less likely than it was before the syringe programs were there that they would be pricked by a contaminated syringe. So, again, instead of helping the public to understand these things, the correctional services at the federal level, anyway, has not listened to the Public Health Service, which has been trying to push the idea of at least a pilot syringe program, and instead is continuing to say that there isn't drug injection in the prisons, and that's just crazy.
Because the rates of HIV and hepatitis C inside prison continues to increase. Is that not the case?
Yes, and there too, it would be nice if correctional services at the federal level would allow independent researchers to go in and study this. But we do have some smaller scale studies from around the country that indicate that HIV prevalence is probably at least 12 to 20 times higher than in the non-incarcerated population in many institutions in the country. Hepatitis C probably even worse. And, you know, there's huge costs associated with that, to say nothing of the legal and human rights issues.
And that was my next question. What about money and fiscal costs in terms of mandatory minimums and this type of approach to dealing with drug use?
Well, it's hard to see how it makes any kind of fiscal sense. Incarceration, as we know, is a hugely expensive proposition. Canada could get a much bigger bang for its buck by investing in drug rehabilitation and treatment programs. We in our organization hear from organizations of drug users and methadone users all the time. We hear that there's methadone waiting lists in many parts of the country. People don't have good access to services that could really help them stabilize their lives. Methadone has a great track record, including in Canada, where it is available. And we know that people can really turn themselves around when they have access to those basic proven health services that are extremely cost-effective. They can be productive. They can hold jobs. Instead, spending tens and tens of thousands per person per year on incarceration and putting people into a situation where they're likely to contract a disease unless they're extremely careful and have access to syringes through some under the table source. And what do we know? I mean, we know that treating one case of hepatitis C in Canada costs on the order of $150,000 per person. HIV much harder, much more expensive, much more long-term treatment. So how do these things make sense even economically? I don't know.
What can we learn from the experiences of mandatory minimums in other parts of the world? I know you've mentioned a lot the United States, and that is definitely one case. But I know there are some places in the world that have been retreating from the use of mandatory minimums. Is there anywhere else that you wanted to highlight in terms of experiences that they've had with mandatory minimums?
There's no place that I know that has had as sustained an experience with mandatory minimums with respect to drug offenses. There are places, countries that have used them for longer periods with respect to guns, which, as you mentioned early on, is part of Bill C-10. I think the U.S. is certainly the most illustrative case because it's been such a sustained policy. And I think that, in fact, even in the U.S., as I said, there are some states where people are looking more at drug courts, looking more at other kinds of alternatives to incarceration. And even in some states, the prison guards are beginning to come around on this because they see the disastrous consequences behind bars of this policy, to say nothing of the fact that prisons are absolutely way beyond their maximum holding limits in many parts of the U.S.
And you've mentioned a few alternatives or different ways of looking at drugs in terms of harm reduction and needle exchanges and other such things. Do you have any other comments on what are some alternative ways in which we need to deal with the effects of drugs in our communities?
Well, I'd like to just say that to me this policy is a little bit of a piece with the Harper government's refusal to pronounce itself on Insight, the supervised injection facility in Vancouver where you are. How could Insight not be seen as good public policy by the people in Ottawa. It's a little hard to know when peer-reviewed published research over and over has shown the excellent impact of this, including for things, you know, for people who have abstinence in their mind all the time when they make public policy. There's even evidence from insight from the supervised injection facility that you know, the people who are using it are more likely to be able to talk to somebody about rehabilitation services, about getting treatment for their addiction. What could be better? And yet we have this, you know, this dithering that's been going on in spite of the city, the business community, the experts from all over the world, you know, weighing in on this question. So I hope that Minister Clements, as well as Prime Minister Harper himself, will begin to see the light on this question. To me, again, this is, you know, the knee-jerk reaction of treating drug addiction, even for nonviolent small-scale users, as a crime, treating it with the blunt instruments of criminal law, rather than looking at the health services that are out there, people's real access to them, people's real access to counseling and support, which we know have better track records, which we know are cost-effective, which we know are much more in sync with the idea that drug users have rights to health services. So the whole picture really concerns me, because once the law is there and law enforcement people feel empowered to make even more repressive kinds of applications of criminal law for people who use drugs, who really, really could be much better served by public health programs, then you really worry about a kind of a public policy slippery slope. And I hope that Canada will be smart enough not to go down that road.
So speaking of that road, where to from here? I mean, we're in the midst of Bill C-10. I think it's in the Justice Committee now, and that's mandatory minimums for gun crimes. The Tories haven't yet introduced mandatory minimums for drug laws. Do you know anything else about what their plans are, or what people can do if they're concerned, and what it's looking like this fall, the fall sitting of the legislature?
Well, I think that Bill C-9 is very relevant to drugs, even if it's not as explicit as it might be about categories of drug crimes, because Bill C-9 is looking to dismantle this system of what I called before conditional sentencing, things like house arrest, alternatives to long-term incarceration. And we're concerned about Bill C-9 in that regard, so I think people should be talking to their parliamentarians about Bill C-9 and how that might, in fact, be applied in cases of nonviolent drug offenses. It's not clear to me that that's completely that's not pertinent in this case. If there is in fact another bill, there would certainly be it would be important to be talking to parliamentarians about this, and I think especially to be looking at the evidence that's out there. We tried to capture some of the U.S. experience, including the Department of Justice's own analysis, in a paper that we wrote that people can find at www.aidslaw.ca. But there's lots of other things out there, and people might, Canadian taxpayers, in fact, might be interested in looking at the Ministry of Justice study, which was paid for by their tax dollars and is a very good study, and that's on the Ministry of Justice website.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today. I know you're on holiday there in California, and really appreciate taking time out to talk about this issue. We have been speaking with Joanne Chetta about mandatory minimums and drug laws. Joanne's the executive director of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. And as she mentioned, there is more information on their website. It's www.aidslaw.ca. And you can also find more information on mandatory minimums at prisonjustice.ca.